This week on the In-Depth Podcast, Howard Schultz.
Grandma, I assume you drink coffee.
I do, yeah.
I mean, if he said no, I think we'd stop the interview.
The former Starbucks CEOs, one of the most successful businessmen in America, transforming the coffee empire into what it is today with nearly 36,000 stores worldwide. He invited us to spend time with him in both Italy and Seattle, where we discussed his inspiration for buying Starbucks.
My life turned upside down. I just knew instinctively that the opportunity to recreate this in America was right there.
And shared how Bill Gates Sr. changed the course of the company's history.
If that did not happen, 100% rest assured, we wouldn't be sitting here.
Schultz also reflected on his tumultuous time as an NBA owner.
If you had to do that period over again, what, if anything,
would you do? I would not have bought the team.
You wouldn't have?
No.
And spoke for the first time about facing union-busting accusations on Capitol Hill.
Never could I have anticipated that we would be the enemy of capitalism.
But our interview began in the streets of Milan, Italy, where he explained the country's enormous impact on what Starbucks has become.
What about Italy makes it feel like home to you?
I land at the airport, and as soon as I touch down, I just feel the energy, the romance. I think back when I came here in 1983, I didn't know anything. I was just searching for possibilities, and everything about my life transformed here. And so I just feel incredibly comfortable and grateful.
Starbucks was founded in 1971.
Yeah.
You joined in 1982. They send you here for a trade show. You decide you want to walk from your hotel. Take the story from there.
There's 1,500 Italian coffee bars in Milan alone. And I'm watching the ritual of coffee, the sense of community. I go in, I taste the coffee. And at that time, Starbucks had only been selling coffee for the home. And I'm thinking, wow, the opportunity is not for the home. The opportunity is in the store. And literally, I race home with the idea and, in a sense, the rest is history. Did we ever think that we'd have 36,000 stores in 80 countries around? No. The entrepreneurial DNA inside me, I need to do something for myself, and this is what I believe I should do, and I can see the future, I'm gonna try it.
What about the coffee shops here impressed you so much back then?
The baristas are highly trained, they're professionals. There's a real sense of pride and integrity. And you know, the ritual itself of people coming back to the same coffee bar every day, the barista knows the customer, and I kind of thought, wow, could we recreate that in America? And then all of a sudden we could see, when we started to open up the coffee bars, the whole thing began to transform itself.
Really?
Yeah.
How many customers do you serve in an average day?
Well, over 100 million people a week come through the Starbucks stores. It's a lot of people. So I walked in here.
All right.
Where it all started. This is the espresso bar I walked into first. I mean, it feels very much the same. And the owners and the people who run the store have been so kind to me over the years. And I think they are respectful of what Starbucks has done, and they know it in many ways it started right here.
Is there anything from that first visit that stands out to you?
I didn't really know what to order. And I was watching what people were doing, and I saw a guy order a Doppio Espresso Macchiato. And so I said, Doppio Espresso Macchiato.
And on that front, I think this might be the...
Good morning.
Can I have a Doppio Espresso Macchiato?
Of course, yes.
I think I should try what you're having.
In the morning, I make that beverage at home, Doppio Espresso Macchiato, which is two shots of espresso and just a dollop of milk.
And what is it about that's your...
I think it's very reminiscent. It's where it all started. I love the beverage. You know, it's very emotional. I mean, it's just to think that 40 years ago, I walked into this place, didn't know really what I was doing. It's like a crucible of possibilities. And my life turned upside down. And I remember, you know, racing home. I was writing notes on the airplane, and I started sketching out a store. And I just knew instinctively that the opportunity to recreate this in America was right there. I was exposed to something that completely lit a fuse inside me.
In a way nothing else to date had.
Nothing else.
There was that kind of drastic a difference.
It was like a lightning bolt.
Okay.
A lightning bolt of just opportunity.
So you get back to Seattle.
I get back to Seattle. I present it to the original founders of Starbucks. And listen, these are good people who just didn't want to risk what they had and felt like the Starbucks business was a good business and we're fine. And left, opened up three of my own, and then here we are.
How big of a risk did you view it when you came back and bought the retail business? Because it wasn't an insignificant amount of money.
It wasn't any risk because I had no money. I had to go out and find investors. It was very hard to find investors to believe in what I was trying to do. It was incredibly difficult.
Almost all of them said no.
242 people said no. I have a fastidious list of people I talked to because it was the original list. I check mark, cross out, check mark, get back to. I have all those people, many of whom over the years I've met, and they said, you know, you never came to me for money. And I said, no, actually, I did.
That's a bad day for them.
Our conversation resumed 3 months later and over 5,000 miles away in Seattle at the Schultz Family Foundation.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you can pretty much pick a year from your childhood and recite the Yankees roster.
My relationship with my father, unfortunately, was not great, but the one place that we found love and harmony and really togetherness was at Yankee Stadium. And we'd take the train from Brooklyn and we'd end up in the right field bleachers. And that's, I guess, what he could afford at the time. To me, it was great seats. Roger Maris was the right fielder in 1961. I was 8 years old, and 61 was an extraordinary year for the Yankees. And certainly, I could recite the batting order, the field positions, the numbers of every player. The Yankees have been part of my life almost too much. I can't go to bed without checking the box score of the Yankees.
Okay, so somebody close to you said they've been with you in front of a whiteboard where you scribbled it out. So we actually picked the year. And
I think 61 is the great year. I mean, that's the great year when the Yankees were unbelievable. So Whitey Ford was the pitcher. He was number 16. The trivia of 61 in the catching position is quite complex because there were three catchers. There was Yogi Berra, which everybody knows. There was Elston Howard, which everybody knows. And then there was Johnny Blanchard. Now, Yogi was getting old, and so he didn't catch very often. They actually would put Yogi in left field. So then first base was Moose Skowron. Number 14, Moose. Second base was Bobby Richardson. Shortstop was Tony Kubek. You getting all this?
Yeah.
Number 10. Third base was Cleet Boyer. His brother played for the Cardinals. Now, left field is where you get interesting because Berra played left field. Johnny Blanchard played left field. So let's just put Berra there. Center field, of course, was the man, my hero growing up. All my underwear, everything I owned was Mickey Mantle. And then Roger Maris, who hit 61 home runs that year, number 9, was in right field. Now, the trivia of 61 is, of course, the Yankees had an extraordinary year, but the trivia is 5 Yankees hit 20 home runs or more. Mantle, Maris, Berra, Howard, and Johnny Blanchard. And of course, the Yankees went on. 61 was an extraordinary year. Here it is.
What was it about Mickey Mantle that
really
made him your hero? Because when he passed, you got calls from people as well.
Well, not only that, I went to both Mickey Mantle days. I think the first one was September 18th. Oh, my God. September 18th and then June 8th. And there were three teams in New York when I was a kid. And there was a great debate between who was the best center fielder, Duke Snider, Mickey Mantle, or Willie Mays. And it was an unbelievable time in New York when the three baseball teams. But Mantle was such an iconic figure. And, you know, growing up, every kid, we'd play stickball in the street and we would mimic the Mick stance and what he did when he ran and he, you know, how he took his baseball cap off at the end of the play. He was unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm told if you ever were to consider owning a team again, it would be only if a baseball team.
Well, I think those days have passed, but I got to know Hal Steinbrenner last year, and he was kind enough to allow me to have some behind-the-scenes moments at Yankee Stadium, which I just wish my father would have been alive to see it.
There was a game once when you were in Boston watching the Yankees play, and you're in the Red Sox owner's box and cheering for the Yankees.
That was a terrible moment. We got tickets from Tony La Russa, who's a friend of mine.
Who texted me about you yesterday saying, there is not a better guy on this planet than Howard Schultz.
Well, he's very kind. Well, Tony was working in the front office of the Red Sox, and he knows I'm a massive Yankee fan, and so we went to Fenway Park. I don't like going to Fenway because the Red Sox is just such an evil team to me. So, but we ended up in the owner's box, which I didn't even realize when we went in there. And then in the first inning, Sanchez, who's no longer with the Yankees, hit a two-run home. We started cheering, and then we realized we can't cheer in this box. It was not a good moment. It was a bad thing. And of course, we could stop cheering.
So you were a high school quarterback,
yeah,
which, you know, kind of become a big man on campus. Then later on, you end up, I believe this is college, getting blindsided by a linebacker. Tell about the injury and how that has affected you later in life.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, you know, you when you have an injury at 18, you don't realize the long-term effects. But I broke my jaw in a practice, and I ended up having multiple jaw surgeries after that, and that ultimately affected my spine. I've had five back and spine surgeries, including a neck fusion, since that injury. And what happened was, I actually broke my neck, and it was undiagnosed. And what happened is the fracture, the hairline fracture I had in my neck, actually healed on its own and fused by itself. And that one area that was never diagnosed when I was 18, 19 years old has caused me massive problems over the years.
How does that impact you on kind of a day-in, day-out basis?
I think I'm in better shape today in terms of the ailments. But one of the things I love to do through the years is that, you know, I became an avid cycler, and I can't cycle anymore. Just the pain of that movement and leaning over. And so I've had to give that up.
Why Northern Michigan?
It was a freaky thing. You know, I was a good high school football player, and I had an opportunity to go to Northern Michigan and play football. When I got there, though, I realized, I was like, holy like, these guys are big and strong, and I'm not as good as they are. And Steve Mariucci, who was the quarterback of that team, was so good and much better than me. And then another great player, Tom Izzo, who's the coach of Michigan State, was the point guard on the basketball team. Those guys became lifelong friends of mine. But I wasn't good enough. I mean, I just wasn't. And so the injury kind of ended my career. And so I ended up not playing college football. That was kind of a turning point in my life where I had to move into other areas of interest and kind of swallow my pride. And it was I was steeped in humility at the age of 19.
So we actually had somebody who sent in a question for
okay.
you
yeah.
that I wanted to play back.
Tom Izzo, oh my God.
Hey Howard, Tom Izzo here. I hear you're meeting with my good buddy, Graham. I just want to ask you one major question. How come when Mariucci and I were trying to get that eeny beeny one little franchise of Starbucks, you could never work it out for us? And then magic came along and you worked it out for him.
Oh, that's bull.
But in all honesty, Howard, the question I have for you, why in the hell did you sell this Seattle Supersonics before you could try to hire me? I was hoping that that day would come. You got rid of him before I could be good enough to do that. Hope all things are going well for you, Howard. God bless.
Oh, that is nice. That is nice. It kind of rings me. It's an emotional moment to see Izzo like that, and I appreciate that you did that.
Why is it emotional?
I mean, here we are, you know, we're all approaching 70 years old. Tom, myself, Mariucci got to know each other when we were 19. Look at how the years have passed. Izzo has gone on to become one of the great, great coaches, mentors, leaders in college sports. Mariucci had a great career as a National Football League head coach, now broadcasting on national TV. And these guys went on to do great things, and I'm proud to be in their company. And whenever I reach out to either one of them, 5-10 minutes later, they text me right back. They're just wonderful people, and I'm touched by that, and I appreciate the fact that you did that.
You ever wonder how things would be different if you continued as owner of the Supersonics?
I try and learn from my mistakes. I think I did not handle that well. I was too young to understand the role and responsibility of an owner at that time.
How so?
The city of Seattle was going through a rough period. We didn't have the right arena. We were losing money. The NBA then wasn't it is today. I had trouble with a player in terms of, you know, Gary Payton was an extraordinary player, but he and I just didn't kind of see the world the same way, and made a trade at that time for Ray Allen, which was great for the team and a great player, but it just didn't turn out the way I had hoped. And
if you had to do that period over again, what, if anything,
I would not have bought the team.
You wouldn't have?
No. You have a lot of dreams in life, and sometimes you got to be careful what you dream for, because it may not be the right thing. It wasn't the right thing for me, and it was conflicting with my Starbucks responsibility. And the economic model of the NBA and a team that was not in a prime market at the time is that we were losing a lot of money and weren't selling out and didn't have a great team. And it really did require a comprehensive full-time commitment that I couldn't give it. And so it just didn't work out. And unfortunately, the team's not here. And I'm very confident that what Todd Lewicki has done with the Kraken and the experience he's created in the new arena, that under Todd's leadership, they'll bring an NBA team back to Seattle. And I'm all for that, and Todd and the ownership group are the right people.
It is remarkable how much these teams have gone up in value.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, wouldn't have been the worst investment.
Incredible in terms of the value of professional sports teams, also the salaries that people are getting paid. But it just wasn't for me.
Yep.
And so it was an experience that I learned a lot from. And as I said, I've had many experiences that have been good and some not so good, and try and learn from them all and not look back.
Speaking of experiences that you learned a lot from, take me to the day and into the room with lawyer Bill Gates Sr. What you recall from that day.
Of all the things that have happened in my life and all of the episodes that have led to where I am today, that was the defining moment. And if that did not happen, 100% rest assured, we wouldn't be sitting here. So Bill Gates Sr. literally changed my life.
And had no reason to do so.
No, I had no reason to do it. And the founders of Starbucks Coffee Company, specifically Jerry Baldwin, 2 years before had acquired Pete's Coffee Company. So Starbucks had 6 stores, Pete's had 5 or 6, and it was a tough economic time, and Jerry bought Pete's with mostly debt. And it turns out that Starbucks and Pete's got into financial trouble. And Jerry came to me and said, I decided that I'm gonna sell Starbucks and I'm gonna keep Pete's and I'm gonna move to the Bay Area. And it seems to me if you could raise the money, you're the right guy to acquire Starbucks. So that was great news to me, but I had no money. And at that time I had left Starbucks and formed my own coffee company called Il Giornale. And we were doing pretty well, but I had no money to buy Starbucks. The purchase price was $3.8 million in 1987. And so the good news is the opportunity, bad news, no money. So I went to my existing investors to try and raise the $3.8 million. And Jerry said, if you can raise the money in 60, 90 days, it's yours. But at the same time, just to cover myself, I'm going to start talking to other people in case you can't raise the money.
Which would have been horrible for you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And he came to me with about 30 days in and said, you know, how are you doing? And I said, I've raised about a third of the money, and I'm confident I'm going to raise the rest. But I wasn't confident. I didn't know where the money was coming. Maybe a week or two later, he calls me up and says, can you come see me? And I go to see Jerry, and he says, I got some bad news. I've got an all-cash offer, all cash, with no due diligence to buy the company. And Howard, I just got to take it. And I said, from who? And he said, one of your investors. And it turned out that one of our investors had gone around me and tried to steal the opportunity. And I tell you, I was just heartbroken. I couldn't believe it. The guy who was intending to do this was a titan in Seattle at the time. He's here, and I'm down here. I would have no access to him. I was in a basketball league at the time, and I'm telling my friend Scott Greenberg the story. He's a lawyer, a young lawyer, at Bill Gates Sr.'s law firm. And he says to me, this is a terrible thing. You got to come in the office and tell Bill Gates a story. You have to. I said, I don't even know Bill. He said, you come in. So next day, he got a meeting with me. And I went in there with Scott, Bill Gates Sr., who at the time was like 6'7", 6'8". He was a titan of Seattle. He was just the man. Now, Bill Gates, Microsoft at the time, was a small startup company. No one knew Bill Gates, but everyone knew Bill Gates Sr. I walk in the office, I tell him the whole story, and he says, I'm just going to ask you two straight up questions. I was so nervous, I was so anxious.
I was going to say, the nerves had to be through the roof.
Awful. Yeah, I was sweating. I said,
my hands are sweating listening to this.
He says, is everything you told me true? I said, Mr. Gates, 100% the truth. Have you left anything out? I said, no. And he says, we're going to take a walk. I don't know where we're going. We take a walk across the street, literally. We go up to the top floor, and then I realize we're walking into the other man's office, whose name should be not mentioned. We walk in. Bill Gates is 6'7", 6'8". This guy is behind his desk, and Bill Gates stands over him, just like this. Walks in and said, I'm going to walk out of this office and you are going to stand down and Howard Schultz and Starbucks Coffee are going to never hear from you again. Are we clear? I'm just like, holy and the guy kind of wilts and says, I understand. And we walk out. And I just said, Mr. Gates, what just happened? And he said, you're going to own Starbucks Coffee Company, and my son and I are going to help you. And they did. And we bought the company for $3.8 million. Now, Bill Gates Sr. never told a soul what he did for me. And at every opportunity I had throughout the years, I'd find an opportunity to thank him. And he just never he just shrugged it off. Now, the other story, if you wanted it,
sure.
3 years ago, I'm at the Microsoft CEO Summit. You know, every CEO in the world is there, and Bill and Melinda Gates are in the front row. So I tell the story in front of that whole group, and I'm getting off the stage. Bill meets me halfway, and he says, who's the guy? Who's the guy? And I tell him, and he says, holy he didn't know. He didn't know his father did it. So the truth is, Bill Gates Sr. is directly responsible for my success and Starbucks growth and development. That's a fact.
The year you were raising money, I understand, was arguably the hardest of your life.
Yeah.
Tell about, if you could, the walk your wife's dad asked you to go on with him.
So Sherry was pregnant with Jordan, so the year was 1986. I had no salary as we were raising money for Il Giornale. And
in context here is also you gave up a high-paying job in New York to pursue what had become your dream.
Yes. I had no income. Sherry was working and pregnant. And Il Giornale was a dream, you know, just trying to make it happen. And it wasn't going well. I couldn't raise the money. And Sherry's parents came out to Seattle from Ohio. And one afternoon, Sherry's father literally said, let's take a walk. And I thought it was, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I got clear to me when he said, let's sit down. I want to have a serious talk with you. And her father was a great, great guy. And just turned to me and said, listen, I think you need to get a job. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you don't have a job. You know, you don't have a salary. My daughter's 7 months pregnant and working. You have a hobby. You need to make some money. And I started crying. I was so embarrassed. When I came back to the house and told Sherry the story, if she would have at that moment said, my dad's right, this isn't working. I mean, and she was resolute in saying, my dad should have never said that, and you got to follow your dreams, and we're going to make it. A defining moment, if she would have said, I think he's right, there'd be no Starbucks.
The role you and Sherry play in one another's life is what?
Well, I think we've had this extraordinary 40-year marriage and partnership. Like any marriage, is ups and downs. You know, I had to sacrifice a lot during the growth years of Starbucks. I've traveled 200,000 commercial miles a year for probably 5 years, and probably missed a lot as a father in those early years about the things I was trying to do. But Sherry was the glue, and now we're sitting in the Family Foundation office. 25 years ago, Sherry was on the streets of Seattle helping homeless kids, disenfranchised kids. And that started her level of compassion and empathy for both opportunity youth and marginalized communities. And here we are in the office of the foundation doing great things because of her leadership.
I'm told each of you have always pushed one another to maintain your individual independence.
Well, I think, you know, you can't build a 40-year partnership in a marriage if there isn't both togetherness, independent interest, respect and dignity, because there are going to be moments of friction and tension. And I think you need your friends and your family beside you, and you also need your independence in a way that is complementary to each other.
Your son, Jordan, told me, Sherry really understands you and values you for your faults.
Okay. Well, only my son can say that. Well, I think I think there are faults that I think I display all the time. You know, I don't have a lot of patience. I don't have a lot of tolerance sometimes.
So I've been told that you can get moody. When you get bad, you can get bad quick, and you just don't want to be around them when that happens.
Yeah, I think through my own therapy over the years, I have much more self-awareness about that. I'm a big believer in therapy, and therapy has helped me. I think the key is acceptance, accepting people for their faults. You know, looking at people in ways that values their strengths as opposed to the weaknesses, and not being too judgmental.
How have you found therapy helps?
My father came back from World War II very troubled and bitter. Clearly had issues after the war that we didn't recognize as a family. And I think the issue of shame and insecurity followed me my whole life to try and overachieve. And then sometimes you got to ask yourself, you know, what's enough? Because you never kind of feel fully valued. And because you're always fighting those demons as the imprinting of what happened as a young child. I still carry that shame and vulnerability today. And I try and use it as a strength as opposed to a weakness. And I think for years it was a weakness because I did have a kind of a chip on my shoulder about being embarrassed or devalued for where I came from.
Growing up.
Yeah.
Something that stood out to you was that walk to school where you'd pass these
private homes.
Single family homes,
yeah.
and duplexes, and then
yeah.
One time when you asked a girl out from another yeah. side of town.
When I think I was 17 or 18, I met a girl, and I had borrowed my father's car, and I was picking her up to go out. Rang the bell, I walked in, she wasn't ready, and the father said, nice to meet you, et cetera. Where do you live? And I proudly said, I live in Brooklyn. Where? I live in Canarsie. Oh. And then he finally said, do you live in the projects? And I saw his face just completely change. And the judgment was, you're not the right guy for my daughter. Even though I was 18, 19 years old. I never forgot that. I wish to this day I could have met that guy many years later and said, you know, I don't know if you remember me or not, but I took your daughter out when I was 18 or 19 years old, and you shamed me for coming from the projects. I think whenever I go back to Canarsie and go back to the projects, I am of two minds. I am very, very proud of having come from that place and achieved what I have. You this is a badge of honor for those of us who grew up in the projects, because we know what that life was like. But when I'm there, I have I can feel the scars that I carry kind of opening up a bit, because I do have significant bad memories of things that occurred. I grew up with a lot of shame and a lot of insecurity as a poor kid living in the projects.
How do the insecurities come out in you today?
I think the achievement of Starbucks is, you know, there are 37,000 stores in 84 countries, but it takes a level of drive and intensity. And that drive and intensity is in my case, based on trying to prove something to myself and maybe to the world, based on having the insecurities and vulnerabilities and the scars of being a poor kid and the lifelong shame of that, that never leaves you.
I know you guys had a complicated relationship, but what did your dad teach you about work ethic?
That's a complicated question. My dad wasn't lazy, but he wasn't a hard worker. My dad was damaged. PTSD was not something anyone understood. My dad went to the war at 18, 19 years old. Who knows what he experienced in the South Pacific? Who knows what happened? He came back with gangue fever, left high school at 15, uneducated. And he bounced around his entire life with one bad blue-collar, bad job after another. And he established himself always as the victim and never took responsibility. And I think...
And that made you bitter.
I think I was disappointed in him. I was afraid of my father. He was a physical father.
He beat you up on occasion?
There were moments that he just had a lot of rage. In later years, I think I had tremendous empathy and compassion for what he must have experienced, but there also was anger and disappointment as I got older, not as a kid. But I didn't learn work ethic from my father. The work ethic that I have came from survival and realizing nobody was gonna give me anything.
1960, your mom takes you yeah. to a
yeah.
JFK
yeah.
speech in Brooklyn.
Yeah. yeah.
What do you remember from that?
As a kid, there are moments in your life that you think, well, I'm not going to be able to remember that, but I'm holding my mother's hand, and all of a sudden Senator John F. Kennedy is on stage giving a campaign speech, and there we were. And I think her hopes and dreams for me was steeped in what John F. Kennedy was saying, and so she took me to that rally. We went home. He becomes president in 1960. And November 22nd, 1963, he gets assassinated. My mother's hysterical, crying in our small apartment. And for the next 3 days, she sat on the couch. She never slept. Black and white TV, smoking cigarette after cigarette. And she was never the same. My mother had years and years of depression and all kinds of things. But that was a defining moment.
The role your mom played in your life, and you think the lessons that she taught you would be what, looking back?
So on one hand, I'm talking about my mother's depression, but the other, my mother was, she was kind of a force unto herself. I mean, she kept the house going because my father was kind of in and out of just a lot of bad jobs and stuff. She had an ongoing belief that I was going to be the first person to go to college, and she had an ongoing belief in me. So my self-esteem came from her. And unfortunately, both my parents, my father especially, who my father died in 87 when he was 65 from lung cancer, and my mother died many years later, but for a number of years she suffered from ongoing dementia. So both my parents, my father for sure, my mother of a little, they never kind of realized the success of their son.
Not even your mom when she, because
not,
I remember.
Not to the extent.
I've read a story where you're walking her through Starbucks and she asks you something about who's paying all these people.
Well, this early years of Starbucks, probably 1,000 people in the office or so. And, you know, one day we're walking through there and her naivete, she says, "Do all these people get paid?" And I said, "Yeah, Mom, they do." She said, "Well, how, do you write the check for all these people?" Said, "No, I don't do that, Mom. Someone else does that."
Before speed dial, you remember how many individual store numbers you had memorized?
Quite a few, because I used to call each store for the daily sales. I don't know, I don't remember.
Somebody said they thought 50 to 70.
Oh, easy.
How is that even possible?
No, easy. I've always had a thing about numbers, yeah.
You said the only time I'm not thinking about Starbucks is when I'm sleeping.
Did I say that?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's probably true.
On your mind?
Well, I think that it's inside me. You know, it's I worry about it. I'm concerned about it. I love Starbucks and my family at levels that are just at such a high level.
You still wake up at 4 a.m.?
4:30.
Okay.
If I wake up 4:30. I read three papers, the FT, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, in print, make a French press of coffee, walk the dogs, give Sherry coffee, and then I'm here between 7 and 7:30 or at Starbucks.
I've been told sometimes you put expectations on others that you put on yourself, and some think that's unfair. What do you think?
I think that may be true. I think I've been able to see things in people that they don't see in themselves. And I think that's kind of one of my strengths. And in doing so, I ask more of people than perhaps they think they can give.
In what ways are you a hard boss?
Well, I don't expect anything from them that I don't expect myself. And I, you know, the expression that I've used of my entire career is you must be in the mud. It's very, very easy to float at 20,000 feet above the horizon. But in order to build a great enduring business organization, you need to be in the mud. You need to be in it every single day. And you need to be in it with your people. And then what happens is growth and success is a seductive thing. And it produces hubris. You're not as hungry. You're not willing to fight as hard because you don't have to. You've succeeded. And that's the danger. So how do you create the environment where whatever you've done yesterday is not good enough for today? And that's greatness.
Why do you think you do your best when your back's up against the wall?
I think I've always been a pressure player. I've always been able to find something in me at the hardest moment. You know, I returned to Starbucks a year ago when Starbucks was in trouble post-COVID. I didn't come back because as a savior, I came back because of my love of the company, my responsibility to 450,000 people and their families, but I came back because I knew how to restore belief and how to restore the culture and values of the company, and we had to go back to the core.
And perhaps an even more powerful time was around 2008, Great Recession. You felt like you were on the brink of kind of losing the company.
Yeah, and I think it's... You have to understand something, that success in business is not only not an entitlement, but it's very fragile. When I came back in 2008, Starbucks was facing enormous challenges.
The night before you're set to announce the layoffs, you're thinking what?
I was preparing myself for a company-wide meeting where I would have to announce this, and knowing how emotional that was going to be for me, and I started crying in that meeting. I didn't sleep the night before, and it was a excruciating, emotional moment standing up in front of the entire company and telling Starbucks in order to save the company, we had to close stores and ask people to leave the company. And that was very, very difficult. That was as tough a moment as I've had.
What did that teach you?
You know, not every moment is a cheerleading moment in building a company. It was going to be a fracturing moment at Starbucks, and all I could do was be truthful and authentic.
When you got through it, though, meaning Starbucks was on the other side of these challenges, take me to the emotion of the affirmation at that annual meeting.
I have always had trouble celebrating. So not a strength of mine has been the ability to celebrate. It's been a criticism of people who have worked with me over the years and saying, God, we just did this incredible thing, and you know, when are we going to celebrate?
Where do you keep the analyst reports and major stories from that period?
I have every analyst report that was ever written about the company that was dramatically negative. I've used those as motivation and just put them in a drawer, and every now and then during those periods reminded myself of what people were saying.
Hold grudges?
I don't think I hold a grudge, but I have a long memory.
What do you think the likelihood is the relationship gets repaired with the original Starbucks founders?
It's not that there's bad relations, honestly. We haven't seen each other in a number of years. I don't think they ever imagined, nor did I, that Starbucks would achieve what it has. They made decisions at the time that were good for them. There was no pressure to leave Starbucks. It was their decision. And we saw the world very differently, and that's just the way it ended up.
Succession.
Yeah.
After the first go around, you said, of the list of the most important things that a public CEO has to get right, succession is in the top three. I did not get it right this first time around. Your thoughts on that?
I live by that quote because the fiduciary responsibility of a public CEO is to ensure succession. I don't think I got it right twice for a whole host of reasons. This time around, I think my hopes and dreams is that Loxman is the right guy and want to do everything I possibly can to support him. But I'm not going to live forever. And I also think it's a young man's game. These jobs are incredibly demanding and difficult. Starbucks is a global company. The CEO of Starbucks has to be a global citizen. You can't manage Starbucks from Seattle. So it's a complicated job.
When we were,
I won't be coming back again, I can tell you that.
So when we were in Italy,
and
you kindly invited us to your party, half of the people that I talked to said they think it will be very hard, if not impossible, for you to
walk away,
deconnect.
I'm on call if they need me, but I'm not looking to insert myself in any way. And I am at a very different stage in my life. I want to be the best version of myself, for my family, for my friends. And I want to do things I have not been able to do because Starbucks has been in my mind, in my life, 24 hours a day. And I'm trying to remove it. I need to, for my own mental health.
Fifth grade.
Yeah.
Sun soccer. you might have gotten thrown out of the game.
Oh, my God. Who told you that story? Jordan and my son Jordan and his best friend Ian were in a very competitive fifth grade soccer game. And Ian's father and I, Pete, did not like the calls that the umpire was making. And we got a little carried away. And believe it or not, totally embarrassed, our fault, he blew the whistle and he stopped the game and he removed us from the soccer field. Now, to be removed from a soccer field, it's a long walk. And that was not a good moment for, you know, displaying good parental behavior in a sports activity.
On just the family front, you and Sherry made the decision at some point that it was best to not have your kids as part of the company.
Yeah.
Why was that?
I always thought that Addison and Jordan would be best served if they followed their own interest, their own path, and their own passion. And that if they worked at Starbucks, the pressure on them to perform, do things like their father did, to aspire, I've seen too many kids take that route and not do well. And so what we said is that we would support your efforts in any way you can, any way we can, but not too much. And that you need to go on and find your path. And I think we're so proud of it. Addison got her master's at NYU in social work. She is a social worker helping people and families. Jordan, because of his sports background and playing college basketball, has become a sports journalist and doing so well. I'm so proud of him. And both kids are flourishing. I wish they were in Seattle versus New York, but that's where they are, and that's why we're in New York as often as possible.
Jordan said he's always felt that had you known he would enjoy Starbucks as much as anything else, that you would have liked him to be here with you.
Oh, for sure. I think it would have been great for either Addie or Jordy to kind of be at our side and see all this. They also would have seen a side of their father that I think would be very different. You know, the intensity, the drive. I'm not sure that would have been very healthy. But I understand how Jordy would say that, and I agree with him.
What's the process entailed for figuring out what to do with your wealth after you and Sherry passed?
I think we've been working on that for over a decade, and I think we're in a very good place in terms of the majority of the money going through the foundation, and we've got a long-term plan, and I'm proud of the work we've done. I think it's even going to be greater in the future. I wish the needs of America and the world were less than they are. They're greater than our capacity. So we have to be very strategic, and you know, we're not the Gates Foundation. We're a small minnow. We got to be very strategic and very targeted in the work that we're doing so that we get a return on investment for the money that we're giving away.
Hard to figure that out? I mean, just
in terms
of...
I think it is hard.
Yeah.
But there we have professional people who are helping us. We've been very fortunate to become a friend and a mentee of Darren Walker, who runs the Ford Foundation, who probably is one of the smartest, most respected people in the world in philanthropy. And he's taken Sherry and I under his wing, and we're learning from him, and we're blessed to have him as a friend.
Running for president.
Yeah.
I've been told that those 2 years were difficult for you, especially emotionally.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, first off, going back then and comparing it to where we are right now, things are even worse. But what I would say is that what I tried to do was based on the fact that I viewed then, and even more so now, that the Democratic and Republican Party have each been hijacked by the extremes on both sides, and that most Americans are not being represented in the middle by the far right and the far left of both parties, and both parties have subordinated their values and their core purpose for those far extreme positions in order to maintain their position. And what I tried to do was recognize that there was an independent lane, and I was clearly too idealistic that the country was not ready for a independent candidate to be elected president, or maybe I wasn't the right person.
Do you think the country wasn't ready, or just the system?
I don't think the country
is
ready,
and makes it difficult.
Clearly, the country doesn't appear to be ready now. But at some point, there will be an independent president. But what shocked me, and what I was unprepared for, was the vitriolic venom and the attacks that came from both sides, especially the Democrats. But I think I'm not alone in saying that
whether you are a lifelong Republican or a lifelong Democrat, you don't recognize the parties that were once the party of Reagan on the Republican side or the party of Bobby Kennedy on the Democratic side. And I think the country is really heading to a place where with $32-33 trillion in debt and all the social issues that we have, we are longing for leadership and statesmanship. It's concerning to see where we are in terms of political leadership and where the country sits today.
What do you think you learned going through it?
Well, first off, you know, in traveling the country, and you've heard this before from other politicians, is that the best part of running for office is not being on stage, but it being in the homes of American families and listening to their concerns and their problems and thinking to yourself, God, if I'm in a position, I'm going to help these people. But traveling the country and really understanding the concerns, the issues, and having intimate moments with people who really tell you their story, and you carry those stories with you, and it drives you further in terms of your reason for doing this. And my only reason for trying to run for president at the time was recognizing the condition that the country was in, the condition of America's place in the world, and the fact that I've traveled more than probably anyone running for president, because I've been all over the world for Starbucks and seen firsthand the need for democracy and the need for America's leadership in the world. But America's foreign policy is directly related to the health and strength of its domestic policy. And rhetorically, you just ask a question, do you think we're healthy domestically right now? And clearly we're not. And so I tried my best, it didn't work out. And, you know, I live with that. And it was a tough year afterwards of failing on a big stage or failing in a big arena. But I tried my best. And
how was it a tough year after?
Well, just very humbling. Very humbling. You know, you didn't succeed on a very big stage. But I don't regret that. I tried my best.
Over the past 18 months, Starbucks has waged the most aggressive and illegal union-busting campaign in the modern history of our country. We are looking at a situation where one side has all the money, has all the power. We're looking at another side where workers are making not very good wages, wages that were forced up, as I understand it, by the threat of unionization.
Mr. Chairman, let me say under oath, these are allegations, and Starbucks has not broken the law.
I wanted to touch on the union stuff. And
yeah.
You testified on Capitol Hill. What was that experience like for you?
Never in my life could I have anticipated that Starbucks Coffee Company, that has created 450,000 jobs this currently and 5 million over our life as a company, and has been the signature progressive company in America of doing things that had never been done before, comprehensive health insurance 25 years before the Affordable Care Act, equity in the form of stock options for part-time workers, free college tuition for every single employee, on and on and on, that we would somehow be the target of the far left Bernie Sanders movement in America, that we would be the enemy of capitalism. And so first and foremost, that unto itself is a question that others should ask themselves. I went there prepared to tell my story, to be yelled at from Bernie Sanders and for accusations that weren't true, and tried as best I could to maintain my composure and be statesmanlike and professional and respectful that I was in the United States Senate. And I think on balance, most people would say that that's what we accomplished. And but it's not something that I looked forward to, and certainly very difficult.
What's the preparation involved for an experience like that?
you know, like anything else, you try and prepare yourself for the questions and put yourself in a position to do well. I would say you can't prepare yourself for that.
Really?
Because when you're in that moment, first of all, it's very lonely. You're sitting there with cameras in your face. You know it's going to be broadcast on television, and you don't know what the questions are, and it's a real test of your own mental acuity and capacity.
And you're a lifelong Democrat, and yeah. Republicans are the ones defending you.
Yeah.
What do you think of Bernie Sanders?
I don't understand Bernie Sanders. I think I'm respectful of his desire to help those people who he believes can't help themselves. I think the method that he goes about it is a question that I would ask. There were many moments that I tried to demonstrate to him that Vermont's minimum wage is $13.18 and Starbucks' starting wage is over $17, and given all the benefits, we're at $27 an hour. Mitt Romney, who I know is the only senator who came into the waiting room before and spoke to me, I took it upon myself to go shake Bernie Sanders' hand before, didn't know if he would or not, he did, and I tried to meet every senator. I was disappointed, dramatically disappointed, that our own Senator Patty Murray, who I've known, who I've supported, would somehow see it upon herself to be part of that circus.
Oftentimes when there are two sides to a story, the
yeah.
truth is generally somewhere in between. What criticism, if any, do you think is fair?
We need a lot more time to answer that question. And I think I'm getting a high sign here that we need to stop.
Oh, okay.
Do we?
Okay. How would you best put into context the success that Starbucks has had yeah. in China as an American company?
It's a very interesting question that you're asking at a very interesting time. So first and foremost, between Putin and President Xi, the two of them have somehow managed to do something that certainly in my lifetime has been something I haven't seen before, and that's get the Democrats and Republicans to agree on something. And that is both of them have agreed that China is the enemy of America and China's our problem. A lot of saber rattling and certainly a lot of issues with Taiwan, et cetera, all of which I think are very serious. We've been in China now for 24 years. Of all the CEOs that are doing business in Asia, I probably have been to China more often than almost anyone. We employ 60,000 people. We have 6,000 stores. We open a store a day in China. And I think because of the values of Starbucks and the way we have managed China, we became the first company in China to give health insurance to the parents and grandparents of our Starbucks employees in China, which I think demonstrated to the Chinese government that we were not seeking profit only, that we wanted to give back as much as we were trying to make money. And I think we are a respected brand in China. What I said in my speech at Peking University was that I feel so strongly that there were many more similarities to the Chinese people and the American people than differences. And that my hope and dream is that before something really bad happens that should be avoided, that President Xi and President Biden and their representatives get together and realize the extraordinary critical importance to the world that China and the U.S. figure out a way to cooperate, and how China needs America and America needs China.
One thing that has been really interesting about Starbucks' success in China is, you know, as I understand, most American companies, when they have success, get a local partner. And
yeah.
obviously it's a credit to Starbucks that you've been able to have so much success.
Yeah, it's a company-owned business, but right. it's a credit, literally. It's, you know, there's never one person that is the reason why you are successful. But in this particular case, Our success is directly linked to Belinda Wong, who is the CEO of Starbucks China. It's her insight, her understanding of consumer behavior in China, her ability to build an extraordinary Chinese leadership team. And she might be the most valuable person within the company. And my relationship with her goes back 20 years. I put her in that job. And here's an example where I don't think she thought she was ready for that, didn't think she was capable. And I saw something in her that I just felt, you can do this, I'm gonna help and support you. And she's done an amazing job. But yes, we decided that we did not want a partner. We wanted to be company owned, and it's been the right decision. But China is fragile. U.S.-China relations are fragile. And
how do you navigate that?
That
seems like that's the, because you have social issues and then you have business success and figuring out what that line is.
Wherever we've gone in 84 countries, we proudly carry the American flag with us. We are an American company. In terms of China or Japan or any market, we've got to be locally relevant. And the stores are designed to appeal to the Chinese customer. The partners in China, our employees, are very proud to work for Starbucks. But one of the extraordinary moments was a young Chinese Starbucks partner, employee, standing up, name was Noah, saying that Starbucks enabled him to be himself. And as a gay man, Starbucks was a company he could work for. And it was an amazing moment because that's a difficult situation in China.
The foundation.
Yeah.
You wrote in your first book, it may be a weakness in me. I'm always wondering what I'll do next.
Yeah.
Enough is never enough. Thoughts on that today?
I think that's still true. Starbucks is in the rearview mirror, but always close by. I see myself creating another canvas. I don't know exactly what that is. The foundation is run by 25 professionals. Sherry's here most days. I'm here to be supportive, but I'm not the author. But I'd like to paint another canvas. I don't know what that is yet. I have some creative ideas. And there's people around me who are interested in my thoughts, and I'm thinking about that.
I understand there are four or five entrepreneurial ideas that are kind of currently on the drawing board.
Yeah.
Any insight you can give into any of those? Any that you'd want to share?
I think at my heart, I'm a merchant, which is a kind of a dying moniker. Who's a merchant in America anymore? And by that, I mean I'm a curator of things and ideas and products and categories. So what I see is some brick and mortar concept that would be complementary to my skill-based curation and merchandising capability. And it'll have something to do where food will be at the centerpiece.
What are the long-term goals with the foundation?
To make a significant difference in the lives of others. To address the crucial issues and challenges of marginalized communities, to be a catalyst for social networks and access to capital for Black and brown entrepreneurs, to specifically help veterans and post 9/11 veterans with the issues of transition from wearing the cloth of the nation to a civilian job. One of the most difficult moments in the founding of the foundation was when Sherry and I were at a military base and we were in a focus group with veterans who were transitioning out. And a young veteran said, I have more anxiety and trepidation about going on a job interview than I would about going back to Afghanistan. And when we heard that, we realized what an issue this is in terms of transition. Starbucks had a goal of hiring 10,000 veterans. I think that'll be at 25,000.
How cool is that?
You know, we made perhaps the most significant contribution to veterans organizations over the last few years. And I think the entrepreneurial DNA also must be threaded into the foundation, where we want to take a big swing and we're constantly looking for what that big swing might be. What we're not looking for is, we're not looking for the stage, we're not looking for adulation, we're looking to do good things. in a humble way. And there are real seasoned professional people here who are heroes among us. Trust me, heroes.
Is there a single moment you're most proud of in terms of the work here?
You know, we had these job fairs over the years where we had a goal to hire 100,000 people, young people, opportunity youth, the ages from 16 to 24. One of the great stories is that the job fair was over. Sherry saw a African-American woman going into the bathroom, and she was upset. Sherry waited for her to come out of the bathroom, talked to her. Turned out she didn't get a job that day at the job fair. Sherry took it upon herself to make sure that woman ultimately got a job. She got a job. Sherry corresponded with her over the years. We just got a letter telling Sherry where she has progressed in her career, linking it to Sherry waiting for her outside the bathroom. That's the story.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
That's it for my conversation with Howard Schultz. There's a lot more coffee content where that came from. To see in-depth tours of both the Starbucks Center in Seattle and the Reserve Roastery in Italy, plus a night in Milan celebrating the release of his olive oil-infused coffee line, Oleato, go to youtube.com/Graham Bensinger. And as always, rate and subscribe. It goes a long way in helping us reach new listeners. Thanks again.